Today, we bring you audio from the Embracing Autism IRL video podcast series. Welcome to Embracing Autism IRL. In this video series, we interview guests from a variety of backgrounds who are all linked together through autism. From advocates to therapists to parents and autistic adults, this series will take a well-rounded approach to sharing diverse perspectives on autism spectrum disorder. Our guests are encouraged to speak freely and be their authentic selves when discussing controversial yet critical topics in the autism community. If you'd like to watch the full unedited video of our interview-style podcast spinoff, Embracing Autism IRL, please subscribe to our YouTube channel of the same name and follow us on Facebook and Instagram at Autism Wish. New episodes release monthly. Dr. Temple Grandin is an acclaimed animal behaviorist and animal science professor at Colorado State University. She's the subject of the 2010 film Temple Grandin, which focuses on her start in animal agriculture. Dr. Grandin has become a prominent author and speaker both on autism and animal behavior. Diagnosed with autism as a child, Dr. Grandin credits her mother and mentors for helping her overcome her difficulties and pursue her interests. Hi, Temple. Welcome to Embracing Autism.
Well, it's great to be here tonight.
I wanted to start off just by learning a little bit about you. So if you could just tell me a little bit more about your journey in advocacy and what inspired you to start speaking about autism.
Well, I had no speech till age 4. I had very good early intervention. I was in really good early intervention by 2.5 years old. Really important. I want to give a lot of credit to my speech teacher, my mother who taught me to read when I was 8 with phonics, my third grade teacher, my science teacher who motivated me to study. I had a lot of good mentors. Now, I started out just, you know, working on designing equipment in the cattle industry. I was livestock editor for our state farm magazine. So in the beginning, it was all about livestock. There wasn't any advocacy. Then I was invited to a few meetings. It started out with the occupational therapists because they really understood the sensory issues. And then at one of these meetings I was invited to, I was approached about doing a book. And my very first book, Emergence Labeled Autistic, it was done in the mid-80s. So it's something that sort of gradually grew. But the thing I want to emphasize is autism is an important part of who I am. But what's made my life fulfilling is having an interesting career. And I worked with a lot of people that are undiagnosed autistics in building equipment, people that owned metalworking shops, multiple patents. And they start out shop class in school. And I'm really glad to read in today's Wall Street Journal that Maine is putting that back into their curriculum with a lot of good success. This is something that's really important. And I've worked with many undiagnosed autistic people. And when I go to conferences, granddads come up to me constantly and tell me, oh, I found out I was autistic when the kids got diagnosed. But granddaddy or grandmother had a decent job because they had paper routes when they were kids. They learned how to work starting at a very young age. So now we don't have paper routes, so we need to replace it with something. And it's very important that these kids learn how to do a task on a schedule outside the family. How about walking Mr. Jones's dog, somebody else's dog? Maybe a church volunteer job. I talked to a young lady who was 12, and she was very proud. She was the church's coffee lady. These things cost nothing to set up, and they teach these really important skills that are different than academic skills. Because where I'm really seeing a problem is that teenage kid is not making that transition into independence in the world of work. That's where we've really got a problem.
Yeah, I do feel like now that we've entered that era of technology, that's become more problematic now because people are on screens and our kids are on screens a lot more. So they're not really getting, I guess you could consider it kind of like an early intervention. What would you consider an early intervention strategy as an effective method for children who are autistic?
Well, let's just start things like getting a little allowance, maybe do some jobs around the house, learn how to save money. I was doing that 7 and 8 years old. Back in the 50s, I got 50 cents a week. That's about $5 today. And I could buy 5 comics with that. But if I wanted a 69-cent airplane, I had to save for 2 weeks. I was learning that at a very young age. And I was learning about saving money. These things are not hard to set up. You can get kids' bank account debit cards. That kind of stuff needs to be started very young. And you put just a small amount of money in it. And getting them starting to learn how to manage it. And the thing I'm seeing today is they're not learning any life skills. I'm appalled at the number of 16-year-olds that have never gone in a store by themselves and bought something by themselves. I am running into this all the time. Too much is being done for them. Well, in fact, I taught one girl how to shop. They came up to me at some airport somewhere. It wasn't Denver, it was somewhere else. And we were sitting in the gate and they wanted to get a picture. And I said, fine. And they got a picture. And then I said, have you ever shopped? I handed her $5. I said, go in that shop across the hall and buy something. And she bought a drink and brought the change back. It's the first time she'd ever bought anything. Now, it was right there. We could sit in that gate room and we could see that store. This was a baby step. But these baby steps are not getting taken. And I'm really concerned about this.
Let's say that there's some of these like baby steps. I assume they would probably differ according to age and also, I guess, the complexity of the autism diagnosis.
Well, I like to keep it simple. Autism diagnosis is a behavioral profile. And your ranges from Einstein to somebody who may have very bad epilepsy and be nonverbal. And then you've got the nonverbals that can learn to type independently. All right, let's just say we've got an autistic person, child, let's say 11 years old. They're socially awkward, but they're fully verbal. That would have been me. And I was shopping at that time. Also, another thing that was done in the 50s is when kids were 7 or 8, this was done with all kids. You put your good clothes on. And when the parents had a party, you had to be little hosts and hostesses. Greet the guests, serve the snacks, take their coats. That costs nothing to set up. And I'm realizing the skills that taught. Easy thing to do. And then we got to do some paper route substitutes. It's walking Mr. Jones's dog, and they're going to do it at 7 o'clock, and the dog's going to be taken to where he wants it walked. So you've got to learn how to do a job outside the family. Really, really important. All the things I've recommended cost almost nothing to set up.
Do you think that it's possible to gain the same type of skills through pretend play? So like if you're pretending to walk a dog or you're pretending to put a party together? The difference there?
It's not the same as walking a real dog. And virtual is not the same. They actually need to walk that dog. And this is something that can be set up in the neighborhood. And then the instant they're legal, they need to get real jobs. Now, there's a few accommodations we need to make here. I want to avoid rapid multitasking chaos at the McDonald's takeout window. Mm-hmm. Don't go there. Mm-hmm. The processor speed is too slow. The other thing that would save a lot of jobs is putting instructions in checklist format. Okay, so you got to close out the Walmart cash register. Step one, step two, step three, like a pilot's checklist. Checklists would help people keep a lot of jobs. I cannot remember long strings of verbal instructions. I have to write it down in a checklist format. Those are two very simple accommodations, and those are needed. And then you need to just set it up in the neighborhood. Who do you know that owns a shop? When I was 13, mother talked to a local seamstress who did dressmaking out of her home and would alter dresses. And my job was to take the dresses apart, and then she'd pin the hems up, and then I hand-sewed the hems. This was something that was just done in the neighborhood, and I was 13 years old. And then I got paid a little bit for doing that.
Along those lines, one of the things that I've heard you kind of talk about is something that you kind of refer to as like teachable moments.
Yeah.
And using them effectively to provide instruction without having to resort to like yelling or negative reinforcement. Can you talk a little bit more about what that means or what that would look like?
Well, let's say we're sitting at the table and we had sit down meals when I was a child. And I would recommend to parents that we need to have at least one meal. It's a sit down meal. And we're going to take turns talking about our day. So let's say I reached across the table and grabbed the serving dish of mashed potatoes. Mother didn't scream no. She'd say, ask your sister to pass it. She'd give the instruction, and it's always done in the moment. And you give the instruction instead of saying no. All right, let's say I'm in the store and I'm touching all too much stuff. Then you might say, only touch the things you're going to buy. And the reason for that is if everybody touches that shirt, it's going to get dirty and nobody's going to want to buy it. You also give the reason. And you just do it in the moment, calmly, in the moment, give the instruction and the reason for the instruction.
So is the instruction kind of like the thing you want them to do as opposed to saying, don't do this, then you're saying,
no,
do
it's
this?
What you want them to do.
Okay.
What you want them to do is, your mother would say, ask your sister to pass it. That's what she wants me to do. Instead of screaming no, you give the instruction of what you want the child to do.
That makes sense, because I guess that's more straightforward, and then it decreases the complexity so the kid doesn't have to kind of think too hard through that process.
No, you just give the instruction.
Yeah.
And then the other thing they used to do, and the thing is, every parent in the neighborhood did this. Other parents did this too. This was standard 50s upbringing. And it was just done really calmly and quietly. They would give the instruction. The other thing, would they cue us to say please and thank you? Like, okay, we're in the store, I pay for something, and I don't say thank you to the cashier. Mother would say, you forgot to say please. We were cued to say please and thank you.
So when you were a child, did you struggle with like meltdown behavior? Because that's something that a lot of kids do struggle with. And a lot of parents have a hard time trying to figure out how to address when their child is doing that.
Let's figure out what caused it. Yep, I had some bad meltdowns. And one of the things that can cause that is sensory overload. That can cause a meltdown. The other thing that can cause a meltdown is frustration because you cannot communicate. You see, I was slow to respond on questions, and they often wouldn't give me time to respond. That was very frustrating. And when I was 5, I remember being very frustrated. I could talk, but I was slow to respond. We had a little assignment where you had to mark down all the pictures that began with B as in beautiful. So I marked the suitcase down for B for bag. And they didn't give me time to explain that in our house, they were called bags. I understood the B concept. That was very, very frustrating.
So what do you recommend, I guess, for parents to handle that?
Well, you have to figure out what's causing the meltdowns. Sometimes it's got worse when I got tired. Another thing with a nonverbal individual, you've got to rule out a hidden, painful medical issue they cannot tell you about. Their stomach hurts. They got an earache, constipated. They've got, urinary tract infection, something they can't tell you about. Because the doctor just says, it's just autism. Let's say you have a nonverbal child and he's been really good or she's been really good. Now all of a sudden she's horrible. The first thing I'd look for is a hidden painful medical. And big number one tends to be tummy and things like that hurting. That's often big number one. So you can have hidden painful medical that sets off a meltdown, sensory overload, frustration because they can't communicate. And then there's some kids that learn to manipulate. I remember talking to one parent. They had a nonverbal teenager. And when mom was driving towards McDonald's, he'd scream because he knew mom would stop. When dad was driving towards McDonald's, he did not scream because he knew dad would not stop. You see, it's sometimes used to manipulate. So you've got to be kind of a good detective. What's setting this off? Now let's look at some of the sensory things. Okay, number one in architecture is LED lights that flicker. And that probably is a problem for maybe 10, 20% of the autistic, dyslexic, and ADHD population. You pull this thing out right here and you put it in slow motion video and you film the room. You'll find the bad lights that flicker.
Oh, you can do that.
You just use regular slow motion video on like on your iPhone. I mean, it should work on an Android too, but I did it on an iPhone. And iPhones are easy to find to try it.
Oh, I wish I knew that.
I learned it from a lighting contractor at a book table one time. I'm always learning things. I got to thank a lighting contractor in Texas that came up to me. Oh. And then we tested this church that I was doing the talk in, and their exit signs flickered. Their big overhead lights did not, and then their sensory room flickered.
Oh, no.
Yeah, that was not good. So you have to find LEDs that don't flicker. And then let's say you're stuck in a windowless room that has this. Well, then find an LED, little battery-operated one that doesn't flicker, a real bright one, put it on the kid's desk. Because I'm always trying to find a way to fix this that's not expensive. The other thing with loud sounds, let's say the kid hates the vacuum cleaner. When I was 5, I was terrified of Mr. Russell's vacuum. Well, you know what should have been done? I should have been allowed to play with it, to turn it on and off and watch its bag inflate and deflate. Because if you let the child play with that and turn that thing on and off, that horrible thing on and off, it can turn into the favorite plaything. When they control the noise, that's another thing. Okay, let's say an older teenager and wants to take a shop class, can't stand the noise of an electric drill. Well, you go in the shop, nobody's there, and get the electric drill out and drill all kinds of boards and stuff with it. Again, the individual is turning on the drill and initiating the sound. Now let's look at headphones. You've got some real serious headphones on there. Now the problem is, if an autistic person wears headphones all the time to block sound, it will make sound sensitivity worse. It will definitely make it worse. What you have to do is have them with you all the time. Have them with you all the time. That's control. And then you go in these horrible bathrooms with all these dryers and flushers going off at random. Okay, you put it on then for that. Or maybe in the subway or just some really, really loud places. But then you want to have it off for at least half the day. But the control is important.
So it seems like kind of like a controlled exposure therapy in a way.
That's right. Well, okay, what do we do if they don't like dogs barking? Well, I can't control dogs. So what you want to do is get a very high quality audio recording of dogs or babies crying. And then they play it at an increasing volume. They can turn it on and off. That also can. But the autistic person has to control that audio device. See, the control is important. You have the headphone with you. So if you need it, you've got it.
It's funny you say that because we're expecting a baby, and that's one of our bigger concerns is how are our two autistic children going to handle the baby crying all the time because they're both really sound sensitive.
Baby crying sound. And it has to be on a high quality audio device that doesn't clip the really nasty high frequencies. That's high quality audio, not crappy audio.
So that is kind of like working on creating an environment for your child that you can really get them involved in sort of these different sensory experiences.
Other thing I want to do
is
take the things they're good at and enhance it. I got an email just now really about a kid throwing a fit and behaving really badly in school, brilliant in math. I talked to a mom in the UK just a few days ago, her third grader throwing a fit in school, and they labeled him demand something, pathological demand something or other.
PDA.
Rubbish. This is a brilliant math kid that's being forced to do baby math. I said he might need to do high school math in the third grade classroom. I'm not suggesting putting him in high school. You can bring a laptop in with a program on it. But this kid needs harder math. Don't make him do the baby stuff. I guarantee he'll behave a behavior problem.
I was going to ask you this exact thing because my daughter also has that kind of like PDA label. She's 5 and she's doing math at like a third grade level and having these behavioral issues in class.
Move her ahead. This is what was done with Katherine Johnson, the famous mathematician that did the NASA calculations. Yeah, she had some horrible discrimination about restrooms and things like that, but her math education was done right. And she was moved ahead quickly.
We try to do that. The schools kind of push back, though. That's the hard part.
I think it's wrong.
Yeah.
And I also talked to an Uber driver. He was a computer science teacher at a community college. He fought at school on this and finally got him to give the kid a laptop with high school math on it. And a lot of problems went away. Now, I'm not a math kid. You see, you have the object visualizers like me who think in pictures. We like art, mechanics, animals, and photography. So my ability in art was always encouraged. I did all kinds of shop classes. That is stuff that I really like to do. I'm terrible in math. I don't understand algebra. I worked with a lot of brilliant shop people that invented and patented mechanical devices that couldn't do algebra. So I'm the art and mechanical kid. Then you have a music and math kid. I'm a big believer in exposing kids to lots of different stuff. Well, I was exposed to musical instruments. I was terrible at trying to play a little flute. Now that kid's going to take off on it, but you don't know. And then you have a word autistic kid. They love history and facts. But we challenge the kid in the area that they're really good at, because they're going to have uneven skills. And these math geniuses that are given baby math, no, this is just wrong. And that's why you've got so many behavior problems. They're bored, absolutely stiff.
What I'm hearing is the importance of creating like inclusive learning environments that are more adaptable to these skills.
You see, I don't think in the abstract. See, verbal thinkers think much more abstract. I'm seeing a laptop in my third grade classroom. Of course, we didn't have that in the 50s. I'm going to turn that desk around. So if I was sitting where Mrs. Deitch would be sitting, I'd make sure that laptop was tuned into that math program, even if I didn't understand it and that he was working on it. And I'd also be in touch with the high school teacher that would be helping him with it to make sure he's advancing. I don't have to understand what's on that laptop. I need to make sure the program is up and he's working on it and doing well. But I'm going to turn his desk around because I want to see what's on that laptop. You see, now I see that. I see our old wooden desk that had the hole for the inkwell, the laptop on it.
That's fun.
You couldn't even imagine what a laptop was.
That's kind of cool, though. Yeah, today, nobody even knows what an inkwell is.
We didn't have inkwells. Our desk had the holes for the inkwell. But I see it. And the other thing is it's something specific. See, one of the problems of verbal thinking is overgeneralization. And I'm seeing specific accommodations. I want to get rid of the LED lights that flicker. Test it. A lot of these kids are going to do better with instructions in bullet point pilots checklist format. That will help a lot of kids. You see, I've done so many of these talks that the same stuff comes up over and over again. The checklist thing, that would save so many jobs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Tons of jobs would be saved by that. It's a simple accommodation.
Let's switch gears a little bit, talking more about the families and the siblings associated with the autistic kiddos. What advice do you have for families who would like to be more supportive to their siblings of the autistic kids? So not the autistic kids themselves, but the siblings that oftentimes kind of get not neglected, but kind of forgotten in a sense.
Well, my mother has talked about this and she said, you've got to have some quality time for the siblings. That's really important. And I can remember my sister really liked theater and plays. So mother, one summer, put on a play that was, you know, for my sister to be in. You know, you've got to do some things with the siblings. They need some quality time and they shouldn't be left out. You see, now, of course, it also depends upon the autism. By the time I was 5, I could do most normal activities. We could go to a nice restaurant. I would behave. We could go to church, and for most of the time, I behaved. We could do normal stuff, go to a movie.
Do you have any recommendations on how to approach that conversation with siblings?
Well, I think you need to just say that, you know, just be perfectly straightforward about it. Just say that there's certain things that I have a disability. I remember my teacher explained to the other children that I had a disability, wasn't visible like a wheelchair. And that was really good in elementary school because then the kids didn't bully me. That's called peer-mediated intervention. But I think there's times where parents might need to go out and do something with the siblings, especially when they can't do normal activity. Okay, go to a football game. Now, that's something by the time I was 7 or 8 years old, I could handle that just fine. But it's really hard if the autistic kid is so impacted that you can't do normal stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like go to a game. And I could go to a game and not have a problem.
Yeah. One of the things that kind of comes up in those sibling relationships sometimes is the parentification of the sibling, where they end up having to take care of or feeling like they have to look out for the other child. Do you feel like there's any particular ways that you can help transition that autistic child to be a little more independent in those scenarios?
Well, absolutely. One of the problems is the moms do too much for them. This goes back to the kid who's never gone shopping by themselves. They're not learning to do laundry. I ended up going to a special boarding school because I got kicked out of a regular school for fighting, throwing a book. And one of the things we did is every week we would load up in a van and we'd go to the laundromat, do our laundry. And then I had a small amount of money in my account and we'd go buy stuff, one of those little things. And I'm realizing how important those trips were because I was going in stores and buying stuff. And I had a limited amount of money in the account. It was like $25 or something a month. You know, now that's probably like $200. It was a small amount of money and I had to be careful how I spent it. You see, that also taught budgeting. Kids are not learning stuff that basic.
And what age do you think you can start teaching budgeting? Like what age would you start having a kid try to go into like the dollar store or something and buy something?
Dollar store, 8 years old.
8 years old.
Yeah. All right. We're buying gas. Let's take a nice gas station, find the pump where you can see right into the gas station, send the kid into the shop to buy a jug of milk. Why are you pumping the gas? And I had one mom go, I don't think I have the guts to do that. I thought of a good job for maybe teenagers. Dollar stores are usually a mess. You've got, you know, one frazzled manager trying to do everything. Well, that teenage kid can go in that dollar store and help him clean the joint up.
That kind of leads to another question. Sometimes, like my children, for example, like if they get into like an autistic meltdown where they get really overwhelmed, they might throw things or they might make a mess or they might do something and like lashing out. Like you mentioned,
yeah, how old are they?
They're going to be 5 and 6 in the next 2 months.
Still little.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I was wondering, in your experience, do you feel like it's appropriate with autistic children to try to teach them like, hey, if you're going to make this mess after this meltdown, you need to pick it up? Even if it was like maybe sensory related or...
No, they still need to pick it up. And then we had a rule when I was 6 and 7. I had a meltdown either at home or at school. There was no TV for one night. Just one night. And the only time they didn't enforce that when it was absolutely truly sensory, we'd go on this ferry boat and I'd be sitting up on the deck and the horn would go off and I'd fling myself on the floor and scream. I was not punished for that. That was very, very, very much the ferry boat horn. Mm-hmm. But other situations, that wasn't the case. And then if I had a meltdown at school, Mrs. Deitch called home. I was in a small school, elementary school. And so, well, Temple was kicking and screaming in the classroom. So I'd get back home. And mother would go, well, you know the rule. You were throwing a fit in a temper tantrum at school. There'll be no television tonight for one night. Just took it away for one night. That's all. Just one night.
One of the things that I learned from that is that when I have to give consequences, I have to make sure that I'm giving it to them basically right after the incident, because they don't seem to retain the connection if it's like something happens at the grocery store and then you come home.
Yeah, now, are your kids fully verbal?
Yeah, they're fully verbal at this point, but they have more auditory processing. And the youngest one, she has more of like a processing delay. So she's verbal, but it takes her a while to process what you're saying. And it takes her a while to put her words together before she could say
it. Well, you see, it takes time. You see, they're like a phone with one bar of service. It takes time to download the web page. So
DSL.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what would you recommend in those scenarios then? Like if something like that happens while you're out and you're not home, do you think that they would still be able to make that association with the punishment of like no TV?
Well, I think they need to clean it up. And when I was a teenager, I kicked a hole in a wall in our house. I'll tell you what the penalty was, fixing it. It took 2 full days because after getting the plasterboard and fixing that, sanding it, I then had to paint an entire section of wall. Otherwise, it would have showed. I never forgot that.
So it seems like your mom knew what she was doing.
She just said, you're going to have to fix it. And she knew I could fix it. Well, I had to go buy the stuff, plastering compound, and get some of the paper tape. It was a fairly small hole, so I stuffed it full of newspaper, put the tape on it. Then you put the stuff on it, and then you have to let it dry. Then you got to sand it really nice, and then come back a day later when it's dry and painted it. Otherwise, it would have showed.
So that is kind of building those like physical links to the consequence of what you're doing.
And I never forgot. I remember it as well as it happened yesterday. I kicked the wall, and my foot, at least I didn't kick a stud or I would have busted my foot. Like I kicked between the studs, and I kicked a hole maybe about like that. I didn't have to cut out a section and put in a new piece. I could span it with the tape and put newspaper in the wall.
I'm going to keep that in mind for when my kids are a little bit older. I think they're still a little young to fix the wall.
Five's a bit too young. Yeah. But let's say they threw a bunch of stuff around and made a mess.
Yeah.
Well, they could pick that up.
Yeah, that's more practical. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So I want to switch gears a little bit as we're wrapping up. And I want to give you an opportunity. I ask this to all of the guests that I have on my show. Our podcast is called Embracing Autism. So I was wondering for you, what does embracing autism look like?
Well, there's some accommodations that will need to be made, like not doing the multitasking jobs, the pilot's checklist, giving the child time to respond when they're talking, slowing down when you talk. I don't think about accommodations in the abstract. I think there's very specific things you do. And I have slides I put them on. There's very specific things that you can do to help the child. And when you're working with the little kids, one of the things that's really important when you're teaching speech is you've got to give the child time to respond. It might take 15 seconds. That's a long time. When you get in their face too much like this, it's going to be like freezing a computer because you clicked on the mouse too many times. Now it's trying to open Windows 10 times. You click the mouse once and then you wait.
That's absolutely true. I feel like I see the gears turning in my kid's head when that's happening. Temple, thank you so much. I wanted to ask if you have any resources, or I think you said you had a book or something that you could share.
Well, I have my book, this visual thinking book's really good, especially for some of the older, fully verbal kids. Talks all about how we need their skills, different jobs, visual thinking, the hidden gifts of people who think in pictures, patterns, and abstractions. I have another book called The Way I See It. It's a lot of little short articles that's has a lot of practical tips. And then I also have books for older people, like Different Not Less, that's 18 people diagnosed later in life telling their stories in their own words. I got a lot of insight when I edited that book. And then there's my autobiography, Thinking in Pictures. And I talk in that strictly about my personal experiences, thinking in pictures. Then I have my children's project books. We want to get them off the devices. And kids don't tinker anymore. I spent hours tinkering with little parachutes made out of scarves and little bird kites. Oh, there's one other little thing. You'll notice how on the back of that's light blue. Some kids that are dyslexic will have problems with the print jiggling on the page. You see, it's only a subgroup, but sometimes try different pastel papers. Print light blue, light gray, light lavender. Print the book or the homework on pastel paper. Just try it. Let the kid pick out the color. And I would say it doesn't work for all dyslexics. It may only works 10% of the time, but when it works, it really works. Now, the problem with trying to diagnose it is that autism is too variable and heterogeneous and it only works on a subgroup of dyslexia. But I have seen that work. I've seen it save college careers. I had a student where it was tan paper. When she left, we had a whole closet full of tan paper. Took a year to use it up.
That is really interesting.
I like to talk about really specific accommodations that we can do that can be really helpful, and none of them are expensive.
I'll have to try that one on my husband because he's dyslexic.
Well, it only is going to work on the ones that tend to see the flicker of certain LED lights, and they'll complain that they'll see the print move.
Oh, okay.
Now, if he doesn't have that problem, it's not going to work. You see, it's a problem in the back of the brain. The eye exam can be more or less normal, but you have circuits for shape, color, texture, and motion. Well, the brain has image stabilization circuits. Nobody really understands how they work. Your eyes move all the time, and things aren't jumping around. There's something wrong with those circuits. And why colored paper works, nobody knows. And someone might say, well, that's not evidence-based. I said, it's colored paper. And it costs almost nothing. It's totally safe. And it might take you 15 minutes to try it.
Yeah, you might as well just try it.
It's totally safe. It can't hurt you. And sometimes it works.
Yeah, why not? So before we head out, so you mentioned the books. Where can my listeners find it? Is it on Amazon?
Amazon has got them. Also, you can go to templebrandon.com. That's my autism website. All the autism books are listed. I also have a livestock website, grandon.com. And that's got, there might be some people out there who livestock, they might like this book, Temple Grandin's Guide to Working with Farm Animals. And I've got livestock books listed on that. And they're also all available on Amazon. And everything's available in ebook, just about everything. And it also available in audiobook. All my newer stuff's available in audiobook. The thing I'm finding interesting is my third of my royalties right now are coming from audiobook. That's really getting popular. Not the ebook. The ebooks, yeah, we sell ebooks, but not as many ebooks as audiobooks.
I think that makes sense in terms of like neurodivergent people, at least.
Well, a lot of people like to listen to them in cars.
That's true.
When they're commuting to work.
Yeah.
So they're in all the formats. And on templegrandon.com, there's all the autism stuff is on there.
Is there anything that I did not give you the opportunity to share that you'd like to share before we close?
Where we're really stumbling is we're not making the transfer to independence and work. That's where we're stumbling. You know, they've changed the autism diagnosis. In the 80s, you had to have speech delay. Then in the 90s, they put in Asperger's, that's socially awkward, no speech delay. Then in 2013, they took all that out. Now it's all merged together. And you've got this quagmire of, you know, huge diagnosis range. But the grandparents I'm talking about, they would be the ones where there was either no obvious speech delay, and they had paper routes when they were 12. You see, we got to find substitutes for those paper routes. That's like walking the next door neighbor's dog is a simple one. Find these things to do in the neighborhood. I was shopping, I'm 8 years old, and I had my little allowance. You can get little kids' debit card things.
I will definitely have to look into that for our children. Dr. Grandin, thank you so much for coming on to the podcast today. We really appreciate your insights. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as we did.
Well, I did, and I hope it's going to help some kids out.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Great to be here tonight.
Bye.
This has been the audio from the Embracing Autism Podcast live stream series. Please check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@autismwish to catch these shows live. Otherwise, stick around next week for our next episode. This is Embracing Autism.